This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English programme, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome, everyone. For years, they lecture the world on the rules-based international order, on property rights, on legal sovereignty, on the sanctity of law. Now, in a move of hypocrisy, the European Union, under the heavy hand of Washington, has simply stolen what is not theirs, $246 billion. Russian sovereign assets seized frozen under a fabricated, quote, emergency. They dress this theft in the language of morality, of supporting Ukraine, but do not be fooled. This is an act of economic warfare, a desperate escalation by a failing bloc tearing up its own legal scriptures to serve a master across the Atlantic. It has shattered European unity with its own members crying rape of law, and it has been promised with a fierce and justified retaliation from Moscow. In this Spotlight episode, we cut through the Western propaganda. We ask who truly ordered this, how deep are the cracks in Brussels, and is this the final foolish blow to any chance of peace? But first, let's get more details in this report.
The European Union has indefinitely frozen Russia's assets in Europe over the Ukraine war. Using a special procedure meant for economic emergencies, the bloc's governments agreed to immobilize $246 billion worth of Russian sovereign assets until Moscow ends the war and compensates its neighbor for the damage caused in the conflict. It's a key step that will allow EU leaders to work out at a summit next week how to use the tens of billions of euros in Russian central bank assets to underwrite a huge loan to help Ukraine meet its financial and military needs over the next 2 years. The move has caused rifts within the EU. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán slammed the decision, accusing the European Commission, which prepared the measure, of, quote, systematically raping European law. He said the move means the rule of law in the European Union comes to an end, and Europe's leaders are placing themselves above the rules. Slovakia has also criticized the measure, warning that the use of frozen Russian assets could directly jeopardize efforts to end the Ukraine war. Russia's central bank, meanwhile, said it has filed a lawsuit in Moscow against Euroclear, a Belgian financial group that holds the majority of Russian assets. In a separate statement, the central bank also described wider EU plans to use Russian assets to aid Ukraine as illegal and contrary to international law, arguing that they violated the principles of sovereign immunity of assets. Russian officials have also repeatedly said that tapping the frozen assets would be met with the harshest reaction. The legal battle over frozen funds is taking place as the United States pushes for a ceasefire deal between Moscow and Kyiv. A draft U.S. peace plan released last month envisioned using the frozen funds for the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. As a result, they're used by European leaders for a loan before a peace deal could cause tension with Washington. But European officials say the alternative is for Ukraine to face a financial crunch. Analysts believe the asset freeze reveals that the bloc is willing to bend its own rules when politically convenient, eroding the very legal order it claims to uphold and exposing deep fractures within the bloc.
Well, in this episode, we are joined by Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, joining us from Florida, U.S. And Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. And Mr. Doctorow, let's go ahead and start off with you. Let's start off with this whole legitimacy on the so-called economic emergency procedure, as they're calling it. Now, some people are describing it as a not-so-simple legal loophole, while others are calling it outright theft of a sovereign nation's sovereignty. I mean, what side would you lean to? Obviously, what's in front of us of basically this over these hundreds of billions of euros, of dollars, excuse me, being stolen by the EU?
Well, let's take this in two steps. What happened on Friday was step one. That is that Ursula von der Leyen put before the member states of the European Union a proposal to end the 6-monthly renewals of sanctions against Russia, which had within it the freezing of assets. That was done as a first measure to prepare the way for collateralization of a large loan, a loan in the amount of 145 billion euros, to be paid out in two annual portions of 45 billion each, and the remainder to be used to pay off a G7 loan to Ukraine that has fallen due. Now, step one, I say, because if the frozen assets could be ordered released as a result of failure at the 6-month intervals to find unanimity and to continue the sanctions, then that would vitiate the basis for having these funds held in collateral. To avoid that, in the anticipation that at least one member state, namely Hungary, would at some point veto the extension by 6 months, they put this to a vote, and von der Leyen won. But I say this is only step one, and it's procedural. It was simply to put in place the holding of those assets, and with the purpose of their being removed from the grips of Mr. Trump, and thereby giving leverage to the European Union in the ongoing negotiations over peace, from which it has been sidelined. So I see the principal importance of what happened yesterday, which was approved, and was even approved by Belgium, which has been the most vocal opponent of the whole notion of collateralization for purposes of a loan to Ukraine. It passed because it was dealing with securing a place at the negotiating table for Europe. Period. The big issue, and which is completely uncertain how voting will go and procedurally how von der Leyen will handle it, is still ahead. That's when the European Council, which is the second executive body of the European institutions, whereas the European Commission is the executive carrying out the daily activities of acting as a cabinet, the European Council meets on big issues. It meets once a month. And it consists of the 27 heads of state and heads of government of the European Union.
Yes, and Mr. Doctorow, if you don't mind me cutting you off right there, I would like to go ahead and bring in our guest from the U.S., of course, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for your patience. Mr. Johnson, let's talk a bit about, I mean, basically they violate the principle of the sovereign asset immunity. Now, what precedent has the West now actually even put into play? I mean, does what stops any other nation at this moment from seizing any European, any American assets in the future under their own declared, quote, emergencies, or would that even be different in the European or the Americans' own eyes as not acceptable because it's them being attacked here?
Well, this has the potential to set off a whole chain reaction. In fact, we started to see it with Russia has now filed a lawsuit against Euroclear. I believe it's in a Russian court. But Russia was prepared, for this step. Russia has the potential to seize a variety of European assets. They've avoided doing so because the Russians, in contrast to the Europeans, are much more committed to trying to uphold international law. But all of this, I think, is taking place in the context of we're witnessing a fundamental shift in the international economic order that was established at the end of World War II. Then the United States has been the de facto leader of that for the last 80 years. But now with the rise of BRICS, with the increased cooperation between Russia and China, we're seeing that that whole system starting to unravel, because the ability of the West to use economic, financial terms as a bludgeon, as a coercive lever over other states is starting to slip. Recall that it was 10 years ago that Russia and China agreed with the West to impose sanctions on Iran. And now, in the wake of the snapback sanctions, Russia and China both said, nah, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to support Iran. So this, this is a last desperate play by the Europeans. And frankly, in the whole context of the war in Ukraine, it's not going to make one bit of difference.
And Mr. Doctor, I mean, let's move over a bit to these EU rifts, to this hypocrisy being taking place at the moment. Analysts are saying that this reveals that the EU bends its rules when politically convenient. But doesn't this finalize the bloc's transformation from, let's say, a community of law to a mere geopolitical tool for Washington? Or has it always been a tool for Washington, in your opinion?
Ahead of the facts. I told you about step one. Step one doesn't violate anything. It's simply enshrines in perpetuity what existed till now on a six-month basis. The Russian assets have not been touched. The Russian assets will not be touched when they meet on the 18th and 19th. These are separate issues, but it's very important to make distinctions here to understand why people are voting the way they are. The second step would happen on the 18th and 19th of December, and that is to invoke the same principle of qualified majority, not at unanimity, to vote on the principle of using these assets to open a loan to Ukraine. That already is the point where the assets are touched. Now, as regards the danger of this, it's not just a question of hollow hypocrisy and saying that the European Union doesn't live up to the standards. There's something much more important going on here, and it could lead to the collapse of the global financial system. My colleague has said correctly that the Russians have put a legal action against the holdings that are in Russia and owned by Euroclear. So it's not just the Russians had deposited one way into Euroclear, but Euroclear also keeps deposits with those countries that it deals with. And the Russians are now saying, much more important than the 18 billion euros in Euroclear assets that the Russians can seize at any time they want. More important than that, the Russians are issuing an announcement to the global community to seize Euroclear assets wherever they are. Now, what does this mean, and what is Euroclear? Belgium is a small country, and people would think normally that Euroclear is small also. Wrong. Euroclear has $43 trillion in assets under its care. If that starts to wind out, if there is an attack on its assets, which put its financial well-being in jeopardy, then the whole system unravels and you have a global financial crisis. So what Mrs. Neal speak about the Europeans, let's be very specific. This is an initiative coming from very few people who are usurpers of power, who are essentially dictators. And the dictator number one is Ursula von der Leyen. She is the one who hatched this idea and is pursuing it with a vengeance. So before we pin the blame on the whole of Europe, you have to look at who is actually the agent of this crime.
Well, as you did point out there, Mr. Doctorow, the situation is definitely more deeper than anyone is expecting. We have to look at the financial part. We have to see the history behind this. Mr. Johnson, I mean, I know we've seen a lot of your analysis on other shows and, of course, everything that you do. I would like to get your opinion on the situation, the significance of the timing specifically about this so-called economic emergency procedure. Is it have any relation to the very fast advance by the Russian forces there on the ground, in your opinion, or does it have nothing to do with it?
No, it absolutely does. And as Gil correctly noted, I mean, this is an act of utter desperation by the Europeans. It just shows how they don't have any other playbook to go to, because the advance of Russia right now is so comprehensive, so sweeping, and so fast that there is literally nothing that the Europeans can do. Even if they, quote, were going to mobilize to send troops to Ukraine to fight alongside the Ukrainians, they'd be months trying to get their act together on that front. And Gil correctly notes that this poses the potential to unravel the Western-dominated financial system. Because once you destroy faith in an institution's ability to protect your assets, people start going elsewhere. And ultimately, it is the belief that they're going to follow the law, that they're not going to play personal politics. I mean, for goodness sakes, during World War II, my understanding is even though Western banks held financial assets of Nazi Germany that the West was at war with, they still protected those assets. And now here, and just to give you some measure of the desperation, they're willing to throw all of that aside. And again, it would be one thing if they could say, well, if we take that $300 billion, by God, that's going to stop the Russian advance and it's going to actually force them to retreat. That's not the case.
But with that, Mr. Doctorow, I mean, you were talking a moment about who is at fault here. The funds are meant to, quote, as they mentioned, underwrite a loan to Ukraine. Is Europe essentially making the Ukrainian people indebted for decades? I mean, they're coming over money that isn't even theirs to give. How is this going to affect the Ukrainians?
You know, the wording of this loan does not envisage the kind of threat to Ukrainians' interest that you are raising now. It states that the loan falls due at the moment that the Russians pay for the damage they've caused. And the Russians will never pay for the damage they've caused because they're the winners of this war. So this is why it is a transparent confiscation of assets. But the Ukrainians as such will receive the money, will spend the money, will steal the money, and will have no obligation to repay. That is inherent in this deal. Everyone is talking on two sides of their mouth. Mr. De Wever has been extremely brave in risking the wrath of all of the other 26 member countries, 25 member countries, because Hungary certainly would not be angry about what he's doing. But he has gone up against almost all of his colleagues and said in this declaration that was issued yesterday by four countries, Belgium, Bulgaria, Italy, and Malta. They all said in voting for that waiver of the unanimous voting procedure yesterday. But we can be sure they will not approve application of the same limited majority when it comes up for a vote on applying for a loan against this on the 18th and 19th. Mr. De Wever made firm statements that he supports Ukraine to the end. That's what he says to the European Commission, to look like one of the boys. When he speaks in Belgium, as he did last week, he spoke in French to a gathering in one of the major auditoriums in the center of the city. He said something quite different, that the idea that Ukraine could win this war is a fairy tale and an illusion. He also said to the editor of the major French-speaking newspaper in this town, that for Russia to lose this war is not a good idea, considering it's the world's biggest nuclear power, if you follow with the dots lead. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here, and it's very risky to make facile generalizations about what European leadership thinks. But I think the real issue, when Mr. De Wever and his three colleagues said that they oppose the use of the Russian assets for purposes of a loan, they said, oh, we can do something more constructive. We can give a European loan out of our own pockets for that money. He's saying that tongue-in-cheek, knowing that no European country other than Germany is willing to pony up 2 euros to help Ukraine because they'd have to go to their parliaments. That is the real trick here. This is what von der Leyen has done is to count down the violation of democracy across the whole of the EU, not just in Parliament, which she oversees, because it means that money will be put up by European governments without going to their parliaments.
Well, exactly, Mr. Doctorow, as you did mention, I'd like to thank you for clarifying those points in our procedure. As we were mentioning, sometimes we've got to make it very clear to the viewers what is actually meant behind the scenes, behind the ink on the paper, if we may. Mr. Johnson, we have around 4 to 5 more minutes. Let me go ahead and get in a few more questions, if we could. Let's just focus a moment on this Russian response / retaliation. They said that it's going to be harsh. Now, they promised this. What kind of form could we perhaps expect? Other than what they did to there in Russia, are we looking at symmetrical seizures of remaining Western assets in Russia, or are we perhaps maybe something asymmetrical, economic, maybe a diplomatic warfare? What are you expecting? What kind of reaction from Russia?
Well, Russia is going to follow. They're going to follow legal procedure. They're not going to act recklessly. They're certainly not going to react emotionally. And we saw the first step of it with the legal action, the filing of the suit against Euroclear that was taken, I believe, yesterday. Going forward, if the Europeans actually move ahead and seize assets, the Russians have made provisions to seize European assets that are still in Russia. And what's interesting is, despite now 3, going on almost 4 years of war, and several provocations, continued provocations by the West, particularly by Europe, Russia has not gone after those assets because they still put value in the notion of doing things legally, trying to uphold international law, and trying to ensure that there's some sort of order in the system. It's the West that has continually been walking away from agreements and violating the laws. As you said in your opening, it's almost like, it's the golden rule. Those with the gold get to make the rules. And from the United States standpoint, they said, well, we got all the gold, so we're going to make the rules. And that turns out not to be the case. But, I think Russia's well prepared to retaliate, but they're going to do it unemotionally and legally.
Well, Mr. Doctorow, with the last few minutes, I'd like to go ahead and direct my last question towards you. We have to bring up this draft peace plan being brought up by the U.S. Now, they envisioned it using frozen assets for post-war reconstruction, according to them. By jumping the gun, basically, and using them now for this war funding, has Europe just sabotaged Washington's own peace roadmap, or is everything we see planned? Was there even a peace plan at the beginning?
No, you just identified the logic. It's to sabotage the American peace plan.
And with that, I do have just one more question. If you could each answer it in around 30 to 40 seconds, your own words. Ultimately, how will this actually accelerate the global move away from the dollar, the euro-dominated assets, towards alternatives, perhaps among the BRICS nations, around others who are wary of the Western financial weaponization? For 30 seconds, please, Mr. Johnson, in your own words.
Yeah, well, it's a further reaffirmation that the West is not to be trusted, that the West is a bully, and that they're going to use whatever economic leverage they have over them. So therefore, the global South, Russia and China, they're moving as quickly as they can to separate themselves from that.
And Mr. Doctorow, your answer, please.
The bottom line is the pitch that the advertiser of a talk show both Larry Johnson and I participate in, My Gold.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of our gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. From Florida, USA, Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, and of course, as always, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. They're joining us from Brussels, Belgium. A pleasure to have you both with us. Well, until next time, goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت.
باید فهمیم.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
ولا تتفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to actually begin discussing some of the jurisprudential laws related to prayer and whatever actually hovers around the prayer and the questions and concepts related to that. Based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, let me begin our session with this question regarding ostentation or riya.
Right.
We all know that this is a kind of vice, ethical, let's say a vice or quality that, you know, a few people are somehow engaged with or they are, let's say, suffering from. If a person is afflicted with riya or show-off,
yes,
in their worship, and they are now struggling with themselves to overcome this, let's say, vice, is this also counted as a form of riya, I mean, in their worship? Doesn't it depend on what kind of worship we are talking about, whether they are recommended or compulsory, for example? How can one keep away from it?
Right. Well, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that any action done for Allah, including fighting against riya, is not considered riya, because you are fighting, you are trying to uproot kriya, to get rid of it.
Yes.
And in order to get rid of it, you do certain activities, you take certain actions. So that's not considered to be riya in legal parlance. To get rid of riya, one must think of the greatness of Almighty Allah, the weakness of his own soul, nafs.
Yes.
And also the weakness of other people's soul and nafs and their dependence on Allah.
Yes.
And also his subservience to Allah, the Exalted. All of these things, if one realizes and perceives or comprehends the greatness of Allah in his own smallness or in his own insignificance, he will gradually get rid of riya, get rid of ostentation, or get rid of hypocrisy.
I see. Well, another question regarding the prayer or worship is that when attending congregational prayers with the Sunni brothers and sisters, you would hear the word Ameen, which is pronounced immediately after the imam finishes reciting the Fatiha. What's the Shia ruling on this?
Well, if it is required, let's say, by taqiyya, if taqiyya requires you to say Ameen in the said situation, there is no problem in saying Ameen. But if there is no such a circumstance in which you are required to do taqiyya, of course, it's not permissible to recite Ameen because it's not part of the prayer. It is a kind of addition to the prayer, which we do not accept. Of course, as Sunni Muslims do say it, but we are not supposed to follow them in their suit, to follow suit and say the same thing.
I see. Yes. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to worship and prayer, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, in our obligatory prayers, is it allowed to say some of the words of the Fatiha, or of another chapter, let's say, or a dhikr in a loud voice, in order to warn a child, for example, who's doing something dangerous or doing something harmful, for example, to himself or herself, or to make the occupants of the house aware of the situation so that they may remove the danger? In addition, what is the status of the person's prayers during which he, through some kinds of gestures of the hand or raising the eyebrows, informs another person of something or a danger or answers his question?
Okay. Well, if the raising of the voice, which when reciting a verse or zikr for the purpose of warning others, does not cause an individual to lose the status of being in prayer, then there is no objection to doing so. It is it's permissible, provided that the recitation and the dhikr are done with the intention of recitation and zikr, and not with the intention and recitation to warn other people. Okay, the intention is very important. So if moving the hand or eyebrows or eye is brief and does not ruin the necessary composure and stillness of the prescribed form of the prayer, it would not lead to the invalidation of the prayer. It's okay if you can do so. If you can raise your voice and alarm someone, you should do so. It's okay.
I see.
Because the composure and the structure of the prayer is not invalidated. It's not destroyed.
Mm-hmm. I see.
But if that's not sufficient, you can recite a word of the hamd in surah and a loud voice, provided that the recitation and zikr are done with the intention of recitation and with the intention of zikr.
I see. Does the passing of hands over the face after the qunut invalidate the prayer? And in case of the prayer being actually rendered as void as a result of this act, is it also considered a sin?
No, it's not considered a sin. You know, it does not invalidate the prayer. Because you do nothing. You just pull your hands over your face, or one of your hands over your face. The religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have said that it is discouraged. It's makruh to pull your hand over your face after you finish or complete the qunut. This is done by Sunni Muslims, but we are not supposed to do the same thing, okay? It is, according to scholars, abominable, undesirable, and discouraged.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take another break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go anywhere.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to worship and prayer according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, in face of the hustle and bustle of city life and the modern life actually today, people find it pretty hard. Everybody actually does that, you know. They find it very hard to find peace and quiet and to stay position your body and your mind in a meditative, let's say, state.
Right.
Right? And when we are about to offer our prayers, we find lots of distractors.
Right.
Is it okay, is it permissible to close our eyes in order to avoid distractions?
Well, there is no Shari problem in shutting eyes or closing your eyes during prayer, although it is makruh to do so in other than ruku.
Mm-hmm.
The scholars have said, generally speaking, that it is makruh to close your eyes during prayers. You should use other methods to gain concentration during prayer. And of course, concentration is a big problem, a big challenge. In this, as you rightly said, in this time and age in which people are running here and there in search of, making money or,
making ends meet, yeah.
Yes. So they are actually distracted.
Mm.
So the thing is that the scholars have said that they should detach themselves from their businesses, from their occupation, from the worldly activities and worldly engagements.
Mm.
And for a few minutes, try to focus themselves on their prayers and what they recite. Okay, if they continue to do this, if they continue to practice this for a while, then they will get used to it.
Mm.
But it's necessary. It should be a continuous process to focus. If a person continuously focuses on his prayers and what he recites during prayer, he will get used to it,
mm-hmm.
and he will not get distracted very easily.
You said it's considered actually makruh,
to shut your
reprehensible,
eyes.
Except in sujood or ruku.
Ruku.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, as the last question, let me ask you this question also to include or squeeze in this episode. At the end, is it, well, you know, somebody asked us, during my prayers, I sometimes recall a spiritual heights and elevations that I experienced on the days of the confrontation with the infidel Ba'athist army. And this helps me, you know, increase my humility in prayers. Does this, or doing so, invalidate the prayers?
Well, it does not harm the validity of the prayer because it's not considered to be one of the invalidating agents, okay? Uh-huh. So if one is recalls what he has experienced in the past during any bloody confrontations, whatever, okay?
Yes.
So this just remembering those things and those spiritual heights will not definitely affect the validity of the prayer.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. That was great. I loved this program and I enjoyed it. And I hope that our dear audience would do so as well. And thank you for tuning in and listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, whereby we try to delve into some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And in this episode, we try to, you know, answer some of those questions related to worship and prayer. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank
you.
Qazvin is located next to one of Iran's main north-south transit corridors. Many people driving along this road also pay a visit to this historic city. And one of the reasons is to eat. So my curiosity dragged me all the way to downtown Qazvin to find out more about food culture in the city.
It is time to get ready for a festival of color and flavor. Everyone's invited. In the city's historic caravanserai lies a kitchen where they turn ingredients into magic. If there is one place you should forget about your diet, it would be right here.
If you're on a gastronomic journey across Iran, you would easily be able to find Iran's national dishes in every restaurant on your way. But to get a taste of more folklore food, sometimes you have to travel to particular areas of the country, such as Qazvin City. I suggest we take a look into the kitchen to see what Qazvini cuisine is all about.
Traditional Qazvini foods are made of some of the best ingredients in the world. It's a pity we can't show you the whole process of preparing all these dishes due to our short program. Only looking at each dish is enough to awaken that dragon in your belly.
In addition to exclusive dishes, the people in this city pay a lot of attention to what they drink. That's why traditional drinks made of herbs and seeds are extremely popular here.
In the old times, bathing had its own traditions. One of them was to treat yourself with traditional drinks called sharbat and brewed herbs after you came out of the bath. That was when the owner of the Sharbat house prescribed you a drink that would help you shape up after a long bath. He did this by simply looking at the color of your face.
Our journey would not be complete without tasting the very special sweets and pastries of Qazvin City. What I have here in front of me is called baklava or baklava. It's a bomb of energy and happiness, the richest and the most outstanding edible souvenir of Qazvin City. I'm going to have one.
To the people in Qazvin, baklava is pride. It is so important that no visitor leaves a city without it. In this old confectionery, they've been baking baklava for three generations. In every corner of this country, you're guaranteed a warm and friendly hospitality. Iran, the land of endless flavors and new experiences. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
I'm a huge fan of the rustic style, and I just love any sort of object that seems to have aged gracefully. Now, today we're going to meet a very special someone whom I'd like to call a magician, a sorcerer, an alchemist who turns an ordinary object into an antique. So, if you love anything a little bit rusty and crusty, then follow me inside. Abracadabra!
Ismail Reza Mohammadi is passionate about collecting signs from the past and has been using the art of patina to create and capture that look. With a sculpting background, several years' experience in painting and photography, coupled with a love for history and Iran's culture and heritage, he has been involved in countless revamps of decor objects and also creating high-quality models for museums for over 20 years. Patina is the art of making objects look old and antique-like. The artist masterfully applies color to objects to create a tarnished look. The whole aim is to build up an old and rustic effect, producing a green or brown film on the surface of the object that seems to have been created over time by oxidation.
Art form is all about finding beauty in the ordinary, paying attention to the smallest of details, and also playing with light and color.
But the art of patina is not just restricted to decor objects. It's also perfect for furniture, such as tables, chairs, bookshelves, and even built-in cabinets. This art form is also used for decorating walls, windows, and ceilings, giving the house an elegant look with traces of time. The art of patina is rooted in history, and its traces go back to ancient Egypt. In the 1920s,
patina turned into a professional career, and during the 80s and the 90s, this art form went through a great transformation and became very popular among the artists. Coins refer to different historical periods in the country, and we all love to have a version of them at home, either in the form of a stand or in the form of jewelry. Today, students in different fields of study take part in patina courses, mastering the required skills and fulfilling their dreams of creating an antique-like piece of artwork. Learning the art of patina is taming the passage of time, respecting and recreating the depth it imparts to objects. A warm, charming, vintage, and time-worn look that takes you back to the good old days of the past. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.